Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Dorothy Gundy, Anna Mateo, Ashley Thompson, and Katie Weaver. Later, the entire VOA Learning English staff brings you a special presentation for the holiday season. But first, this report. How much can walking really teach you? Can you learn enough from walking to make an entire college class about it? Kenneth Keffer thinks you can, and he should know. Keffer has been teaching a class called The Art of Walking at Center College since 2002. Center College is a private liberal arts college in Danville, Kentucky. In 2018, the school will offer the class for credit for about the 13th time. Liberal arts education has been an important tradition in American higher education for hundreds of years. It aims to provide students with a wider understanding of the world and help them understand how different fields are connected.
In addition to a main subject of study, liberal arts programs require students to take other classes in related and sometimes unrelated subjects. Center College is not the only university in the United States that offers such unusual-sounding classes. For example, George Washington University in Washington, D.C., offered a class called Japanese Swordsmanship in 2014. In 2013, Oberlin College in Oberlin, Ohio, offered a class called How to Win a Beauty Pageant. And the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia has offered a class called Wasting Time on the Internet. Yet, Keffer says the unusual name of a class like his does not completely tell the full story of what goes on in the classroom. And the students take these kinds of classes because they want to know more.
Our students are as goal-oriented and career-oriented as any other students, he told VOA. Yet they're fascinated by it and want to take it. Now why? Well, I think that they know that there's something deeply human about walking and about its skill, its art. Keffer mainly teaches modern languages. But the art of walking is really more of a philosophy class. There is a fair amount of walking involved, about 4 hours a day over several weeks. However, the students also read about intense philosophical theories from famous thinkers like Immanuel Kant and Martin Heidegger. Keffer sees the walking as a chance for students to discuss and examine their difficult reading topics in a non-traditional way. Also, he feels that teaching students to enjoy the simple act of walking is very important. This is especially true as more people are involved in jobs and lifestyles where they are sitting most of the day. For his efforts, the Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching named Keffer its Kentucky Professor of the Year in 2010.
Critics of the American higher education system make arguments against such classes being taught at the college level. Many list classes like Keffer's as examples of why the American college experience can, in some ways, be a waste of time and money. They argue that colleges and universities should only teach things that relate directly to building a career. But Stephanie Hughes agrees with Keffer in that this type of thinking is why people need to look beyond just the name of a class. Hughes works in the Environmental Studies Department at Santa Clara University in Santa Clara, California. She has taught a class called Garbology, or The Joy of Garbage, there since 2010. The class is all about how human society deals with its solid waste. Hughes says this may seem like a subject that only relates to someone interested in working in environmental management. But she notes people in many different careers have to face environmental issues. Every single person produces waste every day, and not just in their home, but in the broader industrial community, agricultural community that they're getting their products and services from, she told VOA. And I think it's important if somebody's an economics major or a communications major to consider this and what it means for our society.
Hughes argues that students need to have some understanding of many different subjects. They will never know when their job depends on something they thought was unrelated, she says. Guanani Gomez Van Courtwright agrees with that reasoning. The 22-year-old from Minneapolis, Minnesota, began studying biology at Reed College in Portland, Oregon in 2014. I do have a lot of doubts about whether I'll even work in a lab, she told VOA. So I've been thinking a lot about, well, how can I do other things in science, like explaining or writing about science so that more people know what's going on? Gomez Van Courtwright says Reed offers a study program that lets her take classes in many different subjects. But most of all, she enjoys an especially unusual Reed tradition called Paideia.
This is a special week before the beginning of the second half of every school year. During this week, professors, employees, and both current and former students can teach short, non-credit classes on any subject they like. In 2018, Gomez Van Courtwright plans on teaching a Paideia class on the food that Puerto Ricans specially prepare for the Christmas holiday. She notes that a learning environment which exposes her to different people, ideas, and ways of thinking is exactly what she needs. Will learning how to make a basket underwater, for example, help her decide on a career or find a job? Perhaps not, she admits. But outside of Reed, Gomez Van Courtwright is not sure where else she will have such rich experiences along the way. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
And I'm Pete Musto.
Now, the VOA Learning English program, Words and Their Stories. On this show, we explore the origins and usage of common expressions in American English. Sometimes we tie the show to an event or special time of the year. This show could be tied to any time of the year that features a holiday. Holidays are a wonderful time of the year. They are a time when people slow down and take a break from their daily lives. While holidays are celebrated in different ways, many have something in common: gift giving. And who doesn't like to get a present? Covered in pretty paper, maybe tied with a bow or ribbon, a wrapped gift is a surprise. It could be anything. "Oh, you really shouldn't have," is a common response when someone hands you a gift. We say this even when we are thinking to ourselves, "Yay, I got a present." Sometimes the gift is perfect. "It's just what I have always wanted," you might say. Sometimes it's not. We have all been there. You happily tear open a gift, wondering what is inside. But then you see it, and you are disappointed. But you must not show it. And you absolutely must not criticize the gift and make comments about why you don't like it. In other words, don't look a gift horse in the mouth. This idiom is really old. Way back in 1546, a man named John Heywood supposedly used this phrase in some Middle English text. However, some word experts say the idiom is much older than that. However old it is, people must have used it when gifting a horse was a common thing. To understand this idiom, we must understand a bit about horses' teeth. They grow over time. So checking the length of the teeth is a way of knowing the horse's age. Although I've never given or received a horse, I'm guessing a young horse makes a better gift than an old one. However, checking the horse's mouth would be a sign of mistrust towards the gift giver. This would be bad manners, and it might make the giver feel embarrassed or even angry. The polite thing to do is simply to say thank you and accept the gift horse graciously. These days, horses are not common gifts, but we commonly use this idiom. Today, "don't look a gift horse in the mouth" means don't find fault with something that has been received as a gift or favor. Don't be ungrateful when you receive a present, even if it's not exactly what you wanted. If you complain about a gift someone has given you or a favor someone has done for you, you could be accused of looking a gift horse in the mouth. Besides gifts, you can use this idiom for other things, such as a favor. Let's say you ask a friend to help cook a dish for a party you are throwing for a group of senior citizens in your neighborhood. She comes to the dinner smiling from ear to ear and hands you the dish she has cooked. It is very burnt, and it smells odd. But you don't want to look a gift horse in the mouth. You thank her for her dish and the time she took to make it. Then you put it on the table in the back, where people hopefully won't see it. So next time you get a gift that is less than perfect, remember that it is not nice to look a gift horse in the mouth. After all, it's the thought that counts. This means that it's the thought of gift giving and not the gift itself that is important. And don't worry, if you get something as a gift that you really don't like, you can always pass it along to someone else who may actually like it. In other words, you can always re-gift it. And that's the end of this Words and Their Stories. I'm Anna Mateo.
The state of Minnesota is known as the land of 10,000 lakes. Our national park this week protects four major ones. The National Park Service says water is the foundation of this wild and remote place. Welcome to Voyageurs National Park. You must have a strong desire to see Voyageurs to make the visit. It is not an easy place to get to. Much of the park is accessible only by boat. The Voyageurs, for whom the park was named, understood this well. Voyageur is a French word meaning traveler.
In the 1700s, French Canadian fur traders started coming to the area seeking beaver fur and other animal coats. The product was in great demand in Europe. The fur traders traveled to and from the area for business. They took canoes to get around. The boat trips were often long and hard. The waters and wild animals created great dangers. Voyageur life became legendary. The men were seen as brave adventurers, but they were also romantics. They became known for singing songs as they navigated the waterways. Of course, the Voyageurs were not the first people in the area that is now Voyageurs National Park. People first arrived there about 10,000 years ago. They were mostly nomadic and did not settle permanently.
In the last 1,000 years, Native American tribes settled in the area, including the Cree, Mansoni, and Assiniboine. The Ojibwa were the residents of more modern times. They served as guides to the fur traders. They also provided canoes and other important items. Voyageurs National Park covers almost 88,500 hectares. About half of that surface is water. Creating the park was a long and difficult process. Minnesotan state lawmakers first proposed the idea in 1891. But it was 80 years before Congress established the park. President Richard Nixon signed the bill that finally established Voyageurs as a national park in 1971.
The park protects four major Minnesotan lakes: Rainy Lake, Cabotogama, Namekin, and Sand Point. Rainy is the biggest. It covers about 930 square kilometers. It is a popular fishing lake. Fishers may catch walleye, northern pike, and smallmouth bass. In the winter, thick ice covers Rainy Lake. Visitors can walk and drive on it. Rainy Lake meets with Namekin and Cabotogama Lakes at Kettle Falls. A dam was built on the falls in the early 20th century. Along with it came the Kettle Falls Hotel. It housed traders, loggers, and visitors searching for gold in the area. The hotel fell into disuse in more modern times,
But in 1987, the National Park Service made repairs and improvements to the building. It is the only indoor place to stay in the area.
Nature and art meet at the Ellsworth Rock Gardens in Voyageurs National Park. Park officials describe the gardens as the showplace of Lake Cabotogama. A carpenter and artist from Chicago named Jack Ellsworth built a summer home on the lake in the 1940s. He then designed, built, and cared for the rock gardens over 20 years. The artist also created garden sculptures from native stone. There were once about 200 rock sculptures. Ellsworth stopped caring for the gardens in his older age. When the National Park Service took control of the land, the gardens needed repair and restoration. Today, it is an interesting place to visit within the park.
Voyageurs National Park may be best seen at night. Officials there like to say that half of the park comes out after dark. Certainly, much of its magic does. The most spectacular light display on Earth is sometimes visible at Voyageurs. The Aurora Borealis, or Northern Lights, appear periodically in the night sky as streaks or clouds of light. The lights are most often white or soft green. However, they sometimes deepen into colors like yellow, red, blue, and even purple. The northern lights are not always immediately recognizable, but keep watching. If the light you see comes and goes, or intensifies over time, you may be witnessing the Aurora Borealis.
Along with the northern lights, Voyageurs is a great place to see meteors. These bursts of light cross the area's black skies mostly in August during the Perseids meteor shower. Meteors, often called shooting stars, form when pieces of ice and dust cross into Earth's atmosphere and begin to burn brightly. The display of natural fireworks is a great way to finish the day at Voyageurs National Park. You can fall asleep under the stars and be sure that more extraordinary nature awaits you when day breaks in Voyageurs National Park. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.
In 1822, an American professor named Clement Clark Moore wrote a poem that redefined the image of St. Nicholas. It was called Account of a Visit from St. Nicholas. He did not expect it to be published. He wrote it as a Christmas present for his young children. In recent years, experts have questioned whether Moore actually wrote the poem. Some believe it was written by Henry Livingston, a mapmaker in New York, who wrote and published funny poems in his spare time. But whoever wrote this classic poem, it has since become a favorite around the world. This poem combines the traditions of Santa Claus, seasonal decorations, and gift-giving that have come to define Christmas in America. We give you the staff of Learning English, reading Clement Clark Moore's poem, popularly known as "'Twas the Night Before Christmas."
"'Twas the night before Christmas, when all through the house, not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. The stockings were hung by the chimney with care, in hopes that St. Nicholas soon would be there.
The children were nestled all snug in their beds, while visions of sugar plums danced in their heads.
And Mama in her kerchief, and I in my cap, had just settled our brains for a long winter's nap.
When out on the lawn there arose such a clatter, I sprang from the bed to see what was the matter.
Away to the window I flew like a flash, tore open the shutters and threw up the sash.
The moon on the breast of the new fallen snow gave luster of midday to objects below. When what to my wondering eyes did appear but a miniature sleigh and 8 tiny reindeer.
With a little old driver so lively and quick, I knew in a moment it must be St. Nick. More rapid than eagles, his coursers they came. And he whistled and shouted and called them by name.
Now Dasher, now Dancer, now Prancer and Vixen, on Comet, on Cupid, on Donder and Blitzen, to the top of the porch, to the top of the wall. Now dash away, dash away, dash away all.
As dry leaves that before the wild hurricane fly, when they meet with an obstacle, mount to the sky. So up to the housetop, the coursers, they flew with a sleigh full of toys and St. Nicholas, too.
And then, in a twinkling, I heard on the roof the prancing and pawing of each little hoof. As I drew in my head and was turning around, down the chimney St. Nicholas came with a bound.
He was dressed all in fur from his head to his foot, and his clothes were all tarnished with ashes and soot. A bundle of toys he had flung on his back, and he looked like a peddler just opening his pack.
His eyes, how they twinkled, his dimples, how merry. His cheeks were like roses, his nose like a cherry.
His droll little mouth was drawn up like a bow, and the beard of his chin was as white as the snow. The stump of a pipe he held tight in his teeth, and the smoke, it encircled his head like a wreath.
He had a broad face and a little round belly that shook when he laughed, like a bowl full of jelly.
He was chubby and plump, a right jolly old elf, and I laughed when I saw him, in spite of myself.
A wink of his eye and a twist of his head soon gave me to know I had nothing to dread.
He spoke not a word and went straight to his work, filled all the stockings, then turned with a jerk, and laying his finger aside of his nose and giving a nod, up the chimney he rose.
He sprang to his sleigh, to his team, gave a whistle, and away they all flew like the down of a thistle.
But I heard him exclaim, ere he drove out of sight, "Happy Christmas to all, and to all a good night."
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.